Hello and welcome to Earth Heart and Earth Heart Network Radio with the Land to Mouth Food Farm and Garden Connection. We have every week here with cutting edge news information, tying together all of the various issues that we face all at once. But, you know, when we look at the individual problems, they can seem impossible when you pile them all up. But when you approach it with synergy and respect with nature, learning from nature, and protecting what is left of our ecological systems that are required for that thing called life on Earth, then we take Earth stewardship ever more passionately and purposefully into every moment of every day. So that's what Earth Heart Network is about, living our passion, our purpose, and truly connecting on a personal and planetary level through love, magnifying love, not just as a concept of some idea of airy-fairy of romantic love, but really grounded action every day based on supporting each other and our global community, our family, in love around the earth from the heart. And that's what we do. That's what we do in the garden. That's what we do out there in community. That's what we do in our relationships with everyone and everything, even little spiders. You know, it's springtime. People start freaking out that are afraid of spiders because spiders are everywhere all of a sudden. And so just help the critter out, right? Help the wasp out. Whoever happens to get in, don't just smash it, okay? Let's respect even the tiniest of creatures. You know, I love those black velvet spiders. I just love spiders. But the black velvet spider, they are so cute, and I talk to them, and they are so attentive. If I say something to a black velvet spider, they turn around, look at me, and are just right there listening. And this morning, a beautiful big black velvet spider just walked out a minute ago in front of me with a fly in its mouth, a big fly that had been caught in the window there, and they're jumping spiders. So this little guy hunted this fly and was just prancing around with it. And I tell you, I think he was showing off, or maybe she was showing off for her nest perhaps, but you know, just let them out. Get a little cup and a firm cardboard and just gently cover them and slide it under there and just let them out. They appreciate it, right? They appreciate it, and life will reflect that back to you just when you need it. Well, there's lots of great things going on. Of course, a wonderful workshop schedule coming up at Living Web Farms, and we hope to be joined later in the hour by Patrick Battle for This Week in the Garden, his own exact personal expert ilk on what to do, having been here many years and a devoted organic gardener and many other talents there as well. We'll see about finding out where we're at this week. Of course, we're past the predicted freeze date now. But of course, we know that can be thrown right out the window when the cold temperatures return sometimes. Even snow in May, I've seen here in the mountains. So it doesn't get really, truly warm here in my experience until June. And that's pretty much half the year. It's kind of pretty amazing how it stays relatively cool, but we have gotten some sort of blasting warmer than usual days here lately. But lots going on, of course, around the world. The world is shaking and moving, and volcanoes are opening up right now. Over 40 active volcanoes around planet Earth have activated. We've got tectonic plates shifting. We've got devastating earthquakes happening there in Ecuador and Japan. Many people have died in the last few days from this. We've got Yellowstone National Park heating up, roads melting. Lots more earthquakes happening, one this morning out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. Yes, the Earth and the Ring of Fire is activating. Some scientists think we're in the midst of the pole shift. Talking about pole shifts, there are many different frequencies that are being read in the environment. Giant Tesla waves moving across the Earth. We have lots of machinery out there emitting lots of things, and we've got to be looking at what are we doing to our ionosphere. Gentlemen, what are we doing with our ionosphere? We can't just pump it and jerk it around like a balloon, because it's our actual biosphere. This is a living organism we're part of. And so we've got to really look, how can we make things more sustainable? Well, it's carbon farming. There's a new term it's being given now. Sequestering carbon negative farming and gardening, capturing the carbon, covering the ground with cover crops, helping to put carbon back into the ground, emulating nature, doing it in a way that helps our communities and our own table be a healthier place to eat. Of course, we choose every day, food being the biggest choice that affects the planet. So this is why we cover the topic and help you pull it together. And there's so many innovative things going on that I have great, great hope for our future, because There's so many wonderful, innovative things. Now, meanwhile, there's a bunch of horrific stuff happening at the same time. I call it the Humageddon, the human-made Armageddon that we seem to blindly just commit, even though we know better. So we've just got to do better. But a great, great, nice story I want to lead off with today, and then I'll touch on some of the other issues regarding Fukushima in a bit. But thank you to hempforfuture.com, Hemp for Future, with the thumbs up there, finding in this new story the hemp plant, which has so many fantastic sustainable uses as a renewable resource that's fast to grow, help us protect our forests, let's grow more hemp, cover the ground. Hemp plant is found to eat radiation and drive away toxicity. Yes, hemp fields should be planted around Fukushima. This is what activists and scientists are saying. They want to look at giving farmers the right to legally grow industrial hemp, the non-hallucinatory sister plant of medical marijuana. It's safe to say that industrialized hemp should have been legalized years ago. Yes, it was back at the turn of the last century. Everything, there was much more hemp in use, and ropes and newspaper, you name it, there was all kinds of products out there. And then we got it illegalized, but it's not a drug. It's just an industrial product. It's renewable. It's great. And it eats radiation. It is really amazing what is being found. This crop could replace many crops that require heavy irrigation and pesticides, like cotton, for example. The most interesting fact about hemp-eating radiation was found when the Chernobyl nuclear plant reactor 4 accident caused severe radioactive contamination in 1986. Families within a 30-kilometer area of the site had to be evacuated. Radioactive contamination was later found at 100 kilometers from the accident site, and Fukushima radiation levels are still to be determined. They're still being added to all these years later, and we're looking at over $1 trillion of investing in nuclear energy. Are we out of our mind with that? Of course we have to upgrade facilities to just shut them down and make them safe so they don't contaminate us. There is big leaks going on right now at the Hanford nuclear site, just in. Big leaks happening at the Hanford site. Of course, it's a bad story from the past with things that have happened there, but we don't want to be investing in these death industries that are ecocidal for ourselves and the planet. We've got to be investing in the clean, green things, and that includes planting hemp. And it's fantastic to see that we have seen the plant actually reduce radiation in areas. It eliminates heavy metals. It's an amazing phytoremediation tool. Dr. Alia Raskin of Rutgers University Biotechnology Center for Agriculture and the Environment was a member of the original task force sent by the IAEA to examine the food safety at the Chernobyl site. And she figured out that through phytoremediation, utilizing hemp, among other plants, the soil, and there's also a lot of mycoremediation you can do with mushrooms. Mycoremediation is great as well. And thus, the food supply can be saved from the toxicity. It can be remediated. It can be healed through biology. Phytoremediation is the process whereby green plants remove toxins from the soil. Plants can extract specific elements within their ecosystem and still thrive. They can transform, just like we found out the little roly-poly bug. And, you know, I don't even know the scientific name for that. It's not an insect, it's a crustacean. But, you know, I found out recently, we found out here on the show, they have the ability, those little bugs that you see almost everywhere, they're just all over the place, here in the soil, like right there in that crack in the grass, right between the grass and the sidewalk, you find them all over the place, and they curl up, right? They actually can process heavy metal out of the soil. They can eat it and crystallize it in this little special part of their gut, and they even have they're a marsupium. They even have a little pouch for their babies. I had no idea. And, you know, we're learning more and more about various kinds of phytoremediation, insect, you know, etymological remediation by adding various insects and plants and helping to clean and rebuild the life in the soil. So it's really wonderful to see. You know, sunflowers have been known for centuries to be able to help eliminate heavy metals and pesticides from damaged soil. Two members of the mustard family are also useful for this process, Brassica juncea and Brassica carinata. But it seems hemp is quite amazing at sucking up radiation. So they are, you know, we've got all kinds of ways we're going to be having to deal with all this radiation that we've been allowing to spew out there, and all the radiation sites that are spewing that are not being talked about because they're out there and they're in our communities on the way to shutting all these places down, because we don't need time bombs going off all the time unexpectedly by having these kind of dastardly technologies in operation. So it's obvious we need to shift away from all of that. But in the meantime, we can be bioremediating our way right through it and healing the soil and planting the gardens and the cover crops as we go to speed up the process and to help restore what has been lost and maybe restore and replenish that, because that's the abundance of nature. That is the beauty of it all, that nature is abundant. It is abundant with us, and that's why we can abundantly share the bounty of what nature offers. So great to see looking at this, and California is one of the states that has been hardest hit. They have already legalized industrial hemp. They've got all the radiation happening over there, but they have to wait for the federal government to give states the right before they can grow it. They need to be growing this out there. They need to be pushing ahead. The Farm Bill only allows research growth at certain institutions in 10 states currently, and you know that's a monopolized situation there. And meanwhile, the Farm Bill is being sucked on by all of these billionaires that are industrialized toxic farming that we're subsidizing through the Farm Bill. Why? We need to shift our dollars to where our life force is in having a sustainable economy and a powerful agricultural model. We have so much, you know, the United States has more farmland per square mile than other countries in the world. We have a lot of arable farmland. We've got a lot of great areas, and we need to be making them organic so that we can improve our quality of life. We've got so many diseases out there just from poisons that are being produced and sold in our food and contaminating our environment. So if we turn that around, we improve our health. The health of the soil is our health. So it's really interesting. You know, you look back and George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, they grew hemp. In light of Fukushima and all of the things going on with that, the urgent disaster, there are signs of life all over the Pacific Ocean being decimated. We've already had millions of marine mammals washing up. So much melted starfish. I mean, you name it, it is the horrible thing going on because of Fukushima. We've got to get urgent about the radiation situation in our Pacific Ocean. And it's just been breaking my heart ever since it happened to think that they're all getting exposed to this stuff. And there's being mutated whales and dolphins wash up dead with two heads and two double-bodied dolphin fused together that has never been seen before, and a Siamese twin mutated whale babies never been seen before washing up dead, because it's just a dead-end road, that whole thing. So let's get growing hemp. Let's start eating up that radiation. Let's take care of the earth and our relationship to it, and get our federal representatives to help us. Let's be vocal. Pass it in more states. Let's get it legalized out there. This is industrial hemp. We need it. We've got to join our country's co-founders, the founders, part of our founding fathers over there, and grow it. And thank gosh for guys like Mike Lewis out there in Kentucky. Just got his new farm. Congratulations. He's going to be growing hemp over there and lots of other stuff. So way to go, Mike. And he's doing lots of great activism in this industrial hemp market. But hempforfuture.com, talking about eating the radiation. Isn't that interesting? I love learning things like that because it's so interesting. We learn how we can truly utilize nature to work with it to help improve situations that we've already mucked up by doing incorrectly. And, you know, one of the things that we've got pretty mucked up right now is our federal farm subsidies. We've got rich getting richer here, 50 billionaires. Thank you, Robert Coleman, governor, government affairs analyst with Environmental Working Group. Yes, from AgMag blog, Feeding Your Mind, Saving the Planet. I love finding these wonderful people that really tell us these stories, because how are we going to find this stuff out? You know, and this just came in. Federal farm subsidies, he's put this together. They're not exactly for struggling families and farmers right now. 50 members of the Forbes 400 list of the richest Americans, including tycoon David Rockefeller Sr., Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen, stockbroker Charles Schwab, and dozens of other billionaires got at least $6.3 million in farm subsidies between 1995 and 2014. That's according to an Environmental Working Group analysis. And they likely received even more subsidies through the Federal Crop Insurance Program. So Environmental Working Group matched the Environmental Working Group's farm subsidy database with the Forbes 400 list. They found that the billionaires who received farm subsidies between 1995 and 2014 have a collective net worth of $331 billion based on Forbes' estimates of their wealth. So we are paying big bucks to help toxic agriculture do the dirty deeds of ruining our soil and producing toxic food. And, you know, these are not all, you know, organic companies here. We're talking about GMO corn, GMO soybeans, sorghum, cotton, rice, barley, commodities that are eligible for both traditional farm subsidies and crop insurance subsidies. Only two of the billionaires exclusively raise livestock, which aren't eligible for subsidies but qualify for disaster assistance. Commodity subsidies are subject to a modest means test that was tightened under the 2014 Farm Bill. Unlike traditional commodity subsidies, however, crop insurance subsidies can benefit any farmer regardless of income, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture doesn't have to make the names of crop insurance beneficiaries public. So taxpayers and Congress have no way of knowing whether farms owned or operated by billionaires get crop insurance premium support. So we're actually spending money, and we all know about the recent giant, humongous hack about all the people that have offshore accounts, trillions of dollars in offshore money that have evaded paying taxes in their countries. And this is the kind of thing, lack of disclosure. That's what breeds corruption. So, hey, how about bringing it out into the light? We need to know these things. On average, taxpayers cover 62% of the cost of crop insurance premiums. The net cost of the crop insurance is estimated at $8.8 billion a year over the past 3 years. So we've got billions and billions of dollars going to billionaires who don't need it necessarily. And meanwhile, our roads in our country is kind of falling apart. We've got hundreds of bridges falling apart. And people are sick and obese and more diseases than ever. And we keep subsidizing these toxic models. And so we just got to change the whole model. The whole model has to be sustainable and organic rather than dead-end ecocidal, because this chemical-based ag is killing more than just the microbes in the soil, right? That circle of life, we're right there. We're right there in that circle. So great to see this from the Environmental Working Group investigation found that more than 10,000 individual farming operations received from $100,000 to $1 million, and 26 each got more than $1 million. So these go to very successful farm businesses, and we need to maybe reprioritize some of this money so we can have more organic models going on. Definitely worth investing in. It helps us, helps our health, and we know that there are new discoveries every day about our health and how important the connections in our body. They're having a brand new discovery that's just been known for a few weeks now, talking about having to rewrite the textbooks. Yes, decades of teaching. Many researchers have taught that the brain wasn't directly connected to the immune system. They didn't think there were structures in the body that they were aware of. They hadn't mapped out the thought of how the immune system was connected to the brain. And now, Jonathan Kipnis, a professor in the Department of Neuroscience and director of the University Center for Brain Immunology and Glia, how these vessels could have escaped detection. There is a new connection here. It is a major brain discovery. Big science, major news. It has already been included in one of the top discoveries in the last year, and the National Institutes of Health featured its findings in noteworthy advances in basic research. This is serious new information. We've got a whole new discovery about the connection to the lymphatic system and the central nervous system. They're going to have to rewrite every textbook. There's never been a lymphatic system for the central nervous system. And it was very clear for that first singular observation. They've done many studies since then to bolster the finding. They will fundamentally change the way people look at the central nervous system's relationship with the immune system. And it's very important. The discovery was made by the work of Antoine Laveau, a postdoctoral fellow in the lab. These vessels in the brain, in the area, they have been discovered. The vessels were detected after Laveau developed a method to mount a mouse's meninges, the membrane covering the brain, on a single slide so they could be examined as a whole. After noticing vessel-like patterns in the distribution of immune cells on his slides, he tested for lymphatic vessels, and there they were. The impossible existed. Live imaging of vessels was crucial to demonstrate their function. and they basically worked on this and pulled all their skills together for this imaging study. The unexpected presence of the lymphatic vessels raises a tremendous number of questions that now need answers about the workings of the brain and the diseases that plague it. For instance, Alzheimer's disease. And there are, in Alzheimer's, there are accumulations of big protein chunks in the brain. And I had just read the other day about a guy, he was a surgeon actually, and his wife got this, she was going to get this, she had this disease, and it was, he had this theory that it was cutting off the vessels into her brain. And this is what he was on to as well. You know, I just happened to come across two different angles on this same story about the vessels going to the brain. And he went in there and he knew about those protein chunks. So he said, let me just take them out in a surgery. And he did. And then she got better. But it was a surgery. So now looking at these vessels, the lymphatic vessels that really help the brain work well, they look different with age, and aging plays another avenue, and of course exposure to aluminum. And what we have found is that glyphosate is actually a carrier for aluminum in the blood-brain barrier that falls down when you toxify the gut with glyphosate, that then toxifies the gut layer and then gives a direct transmittable movement through that blood-brain barrier in the bowel. Once it's transpierced, and it gives it a wide open advance toward the brain. And so it actually helps make the brain more vulnerable. And meanwhile, we've got all kinds of aluminum out there in the environment that's being picked up in all kinds of tests. When we have rain, we've got all that going out there. So what's going on, right? We've got to have a sound gut. Our microbiome has to be tremendously strong and healthy. But very interesting, a lot of new information about brain health and immune system connections and the gut, and this new lymphatic vessel discovery is amazing. You know, you look at a giant, huge, several-inch thick book, Grey's Anatomy, and you think, oh, they've just discovered everything about human anatomy and physiology over the years. But then you start to realize there's a whole new frontier of awareness right there in front of us. So great to see this will be affecting an array of other neurological diseases, from autism to multiple sclerosis, and it must be reconsidered in light of the presence of something science insisted did not exist. Okay, so they insisted this did not exist, okay, and wow, nope, incorrect. UVA's remarkable brain discovery is big news. It is a breakthrough, and a big thing we learned about the mind in 2015. So our health and our ability to live in healthy ways and allow the vasodilation in our vessels of our whole body to be assisted by drinking lots of pure water, by getting grounded, by connecting to the earth literally, and gardening also. When you get your hands and your feet out there, you actually get exposure to beneficial microbes that act like an antidepressant. They cheer us up. They lift up our spirits. They are compared to antidepressant drugs, but I don't really like to degrade nature in that way by comparing it to a drug that is toxic. But the excellent exposure to good, healthy soil naturally picks us up and uplifts our spirit. And so getting out there and doing all those things that keep us in balance is really, you know, how we can cultivate daily health and making sure everything stays working well. But it's always great to see new understandings coming out, especially when science insisted it wasn't there. And lo and behold, it's right there. And thanks to those great researchers for such a great job at finding it. Well, it's been a big week with some stories out there about some food and things we forget about sometimes. You know, when we don't know where something comes from, we often can totally not think about it. The fact that it even exists coming from somewhere. And all that cheap seafood in the grocery stores, well, where does it come from? Who is the fisherman? Who catches it? And would you believe for a moment who has been caught to catch it? Would you believe there are thousands of slaves out there, these poor Indonesian and, you know, island-type fisher guys that were told they had a job? Next thing you know, they're kidnapped. Next thing you know, they're on an island and they have to process gobs and gobs of fish. And they're treated less important than the fish, and they are never see their family for 23 years. One guy has been a slave in a fishing camp. And tremendous news this week, and Pulitzer Prize awarded to the journalistic efforts of the team that exposed this. So get out there and insist to know, to have a good fair trade or sustainable, some kind of fishing thing. There's lots of different labels, but read, get involved, and don't buy that cheap seafood because it is product of some really awful stuff. And they are contacting these major places that sell it, like Walmart and Costco, and you know, they're making steps to get rid of this stuff off the market, to not have slave labor going into overfishing. Honestly, overfishing, the oceans are already so overfished. It's terrible. I don't even understand anymore, honestly, how you can walk around any grocery store, and there might be 20 grocery stores in a regional area, and every single store has tuna stacked up to here, cans on sale. I mean, how can we still be overfishing that much, right? We've got to step back. We've got to stop while we have a shred of a chance here to help restore these living systems out there. And meanwhile, we've still got, like we talked about, Fukushima poisoning the ocean. And, you know, we're looking at these notorious illegal fishing activities stopping. And another story there in Spain from Olive's Press, Spain's new best daily news website. They've got end of the line there for a big Spanish family who did not have good activities going on, and they were caused to then have been held. And thank goodness these journalistic team of ladies went and really dug deep and really found out how this fish was being caught and have helped to change that. And we are looking at a Spanish family who was also doing a lot of that illegal fishing, and that is being stopped as well. We've got other people waking up about realizing to create special wildlife preserve in areas that need to be restored. And then it's up to us to be able to get out there and make good choices and to stay connected with nature so that we can be able to realize what we're really needing to pay attention and protect and come together. Because that walk in the park or the simple time you take to be outside, it actually changes the workings of our brain in ways that improve our mental health. And it's really great because they have studies of this now talking about getting that tranquility out in nature. City dwellers have higher risks for anxiety, depression, other mental illnesses, and people that spend too much screen time, as we talked about last week, getting in broody moods and, you know, not really feeling in balance and getting out of sorts. And getting out in nature reorganizes our ability to relax, and getting out into the grounded sense of the trees. And right now, of course, in the mountains here, we have the most amazing trees just blooming everywhere, and wonderful flora coming out of every kind of flowers and greenery in all these different ways. And of course, we know that's that greening up of the mountains. It brings that oxygen into the air. And, you know, we know that we can actually be carbon negative. We can actually not only sequester all the carbon out there that we have overdone and overspewed into the environment, but we could even turn it around. And Bhutan has done that, a wonderful place there deep in the Himalayas, the border between China and India. Bhutan is a kingdom that has pledged to remain carbon neutral for all time. In a wonderful talk, their Prime Minister, Sherin Kobe, shares his country's mission to put happiness before economic growth and set a world standard for environmental preservation. This guy is amazing. He said he is going to have a mandate to move Bhutan into the 21st century. He is transforming his nation and maintaining their gross national happiness. Yes, they are doing it. They are putting the quality of life ahead of just the exploitation of life. They're putting life before death, life before ecocide, life before overdevelopment, staying carbon neutral for all time. And that is the kind of leadership that we need, right? The kind of leadership that is bold and powerful and clear and based on action. It is so important to have those action leaders out there. And sometimes people who are famous for one thing or the other, they will take action to make the most of it. If they have some fame, they put their clout behind it. And I'm always proud of those folks when they do it, something from the heart to help. And Leonardo DiCaprio is a little famous for doing it, and he did it again recently, talking about saving the last place on Earth where orangutans, tigers, rhinos, and elephants coexist. And he went there. He is going to help the struggling Lucerne ecosystem, a precious rainforest in Sumatra, Indonesia. It's under threat from industrial development for palm oil. And this is a wonderful place, and it's so cute. There's this picture of Leonardo DiCaprio, and, you know, I love elephants, and there's this elephant that looks like it's smiling, holding on to his pants, and he's holding the elephant's trunk, and it's so cute. It is absolutely an adorable picture. But this lowland rainforest of the Lucerne ecosystem is considered the world's best remaining habitat for the critically endangered Sumatran elephant. We talked about that recently. And thanks to Leonardo, the Oscar-winning actor and prominent environmental activist, spending some time there in the forest recently with Adrian Brody and Fisher Stevens. According to the Jakarta Post, the tour went around with the crew to the Mount Lucerne National Park on a weekend where they stopped by to meet some Sumatran orangutans. He also visited the area and added that to his philanthropic foundation. They're supporting local partners to establish a megafauna sanctuary in the Lucerne ecosystem. A megafauna sanctuary. And, you know, that's what we need. We need our megafauna. I was just talking about recently the manure gap that we have, where we lose our ability to keep the soil fertile because we have already lost most of our megafauna. And it's so great to see the megafauna reserve there that he's helping to found. It's so great because that is someone stepping up and really doing something about it, doing something great. And just like every day right now, you can be stepping up to plant more stuff out in your garden. Healthier organic food is the best for you. And when you grow it with love and you sit there and you put that time and effort and investment of your own attention into growing that food, you become so connected to it. It becomes vastly more nutritious, and it's already vastly more nutritious than genetically modified food or the industrial foods that are out there that are toxic. So sometimes even when we're trying to grow organically, things get contaminated. Another story I just found was Monsanto's glyphosate was found in California wines, even wines made with organic grapes. So we've got some contamination going on there. And you got to realize, you know, I'm glad some people are doing some testing because honestly, we need to be able to know these things. This stuff spreads around. It spreads around even when we don't want it to spread around. And, you know, I'm not happy to hear that. Of course, then out in California, we've also got the radiation levels going on that are affecting crops grown there as well. But of course, this week, the big news being all of the ring of fire around the world and volcanoes all over the place and earthquakes happening in many, many places, 40 volcanoes going off around the world and things really acting up. We're getting swarms of earthquake areas. We've got sub-oceanic earthquake happened this morning and things are really moving. I would not be sitting around the ring of fire right now out there. You know, I think there's going to be a lot of people moving around and things happening. It seems pretty active. Of course, I'm concerned. I have lots of friends and loved ones out there, but, you know, when you're out there, you just know. I lived out in California for many years, and you just know. When that ground shakes and you feel like you're floating like a little sponge in a bathtub, you just know that it could be the big one. And I was in the Northridge quake, and it just kept going and going and rocking harder and harder, and I thought, oh, gosh, here it is. This is the big one. Thank goodness it was not the big one, but it's looking like that might be kind of cranking up here pretty soon based on all of the tectonics and all of the volcanics going on around the planet. I would be heading for the hills, Alice, you know what I'm saying? I did that a long time ago, but we're even looking at some volcanic activity on this side of the country. So we've all just got to be doing our best in our own way to be as prepared as we can. What if the power went out? What if it went out for months? Maybe you have to get a little prepared. Just have your basics. Have some water on hand. Have, you know, toilet paper, things like that. My neighbor was smartly reminding me, you know, those basics is what we really need to remember. And patience and, of course, some resources to take care of ourselves during any challenging weather or times that may be ahead of us. And, of course, growing food is a big part of it. It's very important. But regarding those wine findings, Shortly after the release of a report showing 14 beers testing positive for glyphosate in Germany, a concerned supporter of Moms Across America approached someone at a convention with disturbing news. It was Zen Honeycutt, Moms Across America. They're getting together. This from EcoWatch.com. And he said he had lab results, test results from Microbe Innotech Lab of St. Louis showing 10 different wines from large and small vineyards containing the chemical glyphosate, the active ingredient in Monsanto's weed killer Roundup. And of course, this also included wine made with organic grapes. Not something I want to hear, right? This is not good. We don't want to be thinking we're buying an organic product. And meanwhile, it's not organic product. It's got the poison in there. I don't want that stuff. That's why we got to get rid of it, because it contaminates the good stuff. The contamination of conventional wine with glyphosate was 28 times higher than organic wine, with levels ranging from 0.659 parts per billion in organic, so, you know, very small parts per billion, but still detectable, to 18.74 parts per billion in conventional wine. The wines tested came from Napa Valley, Sonoma, Mendocino counties in California. The brand names of the wines were not revealed. The brands are not the issue, but I still would like to know. The real issue is the widespread contamination of glyphosate-based herbicides in consumer products. But I still want to know. I still want to know. All wines there were from the North Coast region of California, the premium wine-growing region there in that state, including wines from all those counties. They were in two different groups that they tested. And this article here with EcoWatch saying the top reasons why Roundup glyphosate should never be sprayed on any crops, including vineyards. This from Zen Honeycutt, Moms Across America. She says, number one, according to farmers like John Kempf of AdvocatingEcoAg.com, glyphosate-based herbicides are showing up in irrigation water. They're likely present in manure, fertilizer from animals fed genetically modified grains, and drift from spraying. Glyphosate residues have been detected in many foods, cotton products, breast milk, beers, and wines. Number two, wine growers of conventional farms report that their family business used to be able to harvest from their vines for 100 years. Today, with chemical farming, vines are lasting 10 to 12 years. Glyphosate is a chelator. It makes the vital nutrients and minerals of any living thing it touches unavailable. Taking the risk of depleting the vitality of important crops is not a good long-term decision for farmers of any kind. So it's regenerative agriculture that enriches the soil, supports longevity of the farm, and does not use toxic chemicals. We went down to a tenth of time that we can have our vines growing. You know, I used to live in San Luis Obispo, and there are wineries there in California in that area, as well as Santa Barbara. And there were 100-year-old vines in my yard, in the back, on the fence, where the birds would sit. And they've been huge, big grapevines. I mean, huge, just beautiful vine of grapes just hanging off that fence all summer. And they were old. But when you do with chemicals, no, they're not going to live 10 to 12 years. That's about a tenth of the lifespan, because we're just killing the biology, making it unavailable. Number three, top reason why we should never use glyphosate. It has been deemed a probable carcinogen by the World Health Organization. Even the small amount of 0.1 parts per trillion of glyphosate has been shown to stimulate the growth of breast cancer cells. According to California Department of Health, breast cancer rates in the Sonoma, Napa, and Mendocino counties are 10 to 20% higher than the national average. There are many pending lawsuits against Monsanto for the connection between non-Hodgkin's lymphoma and Roundup. Number four, the pig study by Peterson and Kruger showed a repeated 30% increase of birth defects and stillborn babies with the introduction of glyphosate-sprayed grains. Yes, the big gluten intolerance, no, it's really glyphosate intolerance, as well as the infertility and sterility in America, is exactly correlated to the pig study results at 30% increase, exact correlation with humans, with infertility and sterility, 30%, the highest in recorded U.S. history. Number five, French scientist Gilles-Éric Cerellini and his team have discovered that the co-formulants of Roundup, the things that are also in there besides glyphosate, the things that make it work, The co-formulants of Roundup are 1,000 times more toxic than glyphosate and are hormone disruptors. And we can obviously see there's lots of hormone disruption going on and the diseases associated with it. 1,000 times more toxic than glyphosate. The stuff that's just the extra that goes in there with it. Oh, bonus. No thanks. This leads to breast cancer, miscarriages, birth defects, and many other health issues. So, no thanks to the glyphosate in my organic wine. No thank you. No thank you to that. We've just got to get this stuff off the market. It's contaminating stuff. It's contaminating everything. It's detectable everywhere. Even in uterine fluid of unborn babies. I mean, it's everywhere. Because we're spewing it everywhere. So it's time to clean up everybody everywhere, right? We've got to do that. We've got to clean it up, plant new things, and grow our real new future. Okay, the sustainable future, the good one, the one we want to have, the one we want to invest in now so we can sow those seeds of change and reap the fabulous sustainable harvest long term, right? And we see countries doing it, companies and countries investing in organic and sustainable methods. I love when it's whole countries, right? That's exciting. Right now in Bolivia, they are going to invest $40 million. For them, that's a lot. $40 million in local food production. Yes, the Andean country seeks to be the sole producer of its own food by 2020. They say, we want to grow our own food. Isn't that a good idea? Wouldn't that be fun to have? That's a good goal, right? Let's grow our own food by 2020. Try that at home. Try to grow at least 50% of your food by 2020. That would be a challenge, wouldn't it? It means supporting small and medium farmers. That's what the government says, and that's what they're going to do. The Bolivian government will invest over $40 million in local food production in order to ensure the nation's food sovereignty, according to the Public Institute for Food Sovereignty, IPDSA. Yes, Director Hilarion Calisaya announced Friday that food production increased last year by 25% from 2014. And this year, the goal is to repeat that growth. They are looking to increase their food production. Their mission is to ensure that the country does not import any more food by 2020 and that Andean Amazon Nation is the total and only producer of its own food. Calisaya explained that for this plan to work, they will promote small and medium-sized farmers by facilitating the acquisition of technological equipment and the provision of seeds in order to lower production costs and increase the yield per hectare. The Deputy Minister of Rural Development and Agriculture, Marisol Solano, reported that over 20 projects have already been implemented across the country in order to ensure food security and sovereignty. These plans include providing support for breeding small ruminants and strengthening the production of potatoes, tomatoes, wheat, vegetables, fruits, coffee, cocoa, and fish farming. So that's what's up in Bolivia. Yes, that's what they're doing down there. And, of course, quinoa, another great product. They've got a lot. Hopefully they're getting the organic methods going and growing. And hurrah for some food sovereignty there. Thank you, telesurtv.net, for that story. There is so much going on these days. We've got the big presidential campaign running full steam, right? Full steam. Last night, the New York primary between Bernie Sanders and Trump and the rest of the gang out there. Widespread voter fraud stuff going on by the state. Yes, we've got over 100,000 voters purged out of Bernie Sanders' hometown of Brooklyn there. Yes, somehow a lot of his likely voters just sort of got purged. We've got a lot of investigations being opened up right now on this because there's several irregularities happening. Widespread irregularities. There have been a lot of that, those around. There have been a lot of that going on. And, you know, if you really look deep into some of the candidates, you start finding out, wow, do we really want that? Okay, I don't want GMOs on my plate, and I don't want it in the White House either, or at least someone who's associated with that. And that's the head of Hillary Clinton's campaign that worked for Monsanto, okay? The Clinton State Department also was virtually a marketing arm of Monsanto here during her tenure. This is from Food Democracy Now. Yes, as they have previously reported, the presidential candidate and former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has some troubling ties to Monsanto and the biotech industry. And when you dig further, you find even more alarming Monsanto connections between Hillary Clinton and how she used her position as head of the State Department to promote GMOs around the world, and even kind of overstepped the authority there by having State Department officials threaten leaders of other nations for not wanting to approve GMO crops for sale in their country. So kind of being a pusher for GMOs and sort of an enforcer, like, hey, if you don't grow this, we're not going to be happy with you. So we've got to be thinking about that. Right now, a team of Monsanto lobbyists are already raising money for Hillary's presidential campaign to put her in the White House. And what do they want in return? You know, what do they want in return? We've got biotech money being invested in that campaign. And if you want to, you know, you can let her know, hey, tell Hillary Clinton it's time to dump Monsanto and stand with the American people to support GMO labeling, to get more organic food out there, to keep Monsanto lobbyists out of the possible future administration. Every voice counts. We're looking at a lot here. In 2014, Hillary Clinton received a $325,000 speaking fee. What a speaking fee. Wow. You know, that's a lot of money. For giving the keynote address to the Bio International Convention in San Diego, California, to coach industry lobbyists on how to overcome consumer fears over GMOs. So, no GMO candidates. I don't want the GMO candidates. You know, we don't want that. And I don't want all the toxic money going in the soil via the White House with even more overstepping from the corporate line over to the government line from more Monsanto people. We don't want that stuff. And, you know, you look back, and back in May of 2013, the New York Daily News reported the State Department officials under Hillary Clinton were actively using taxpayer money to promote Monsanto's controversial GMO seeds around the world. Hillary Clinton was using our taxpayer money to promote Monsanto's GMO seeds. We can't have that in our main powerful position here of our country, because we're already suffering the consequences of it. And, you know, we've got an organic little garden on the grounds of the White House, and I think that's awesome. We've got Monsanto people not even serving the GMOs in their own cafeteria. But, you know, then we're promoting them out there through our ag secretaries and all of that. No, we can't have that hypocrisy. We have to have safe food for everyone. Healthy food for everyone, food that helps people function so we can do the jobs we have to do out here and work to build the society and the wonderful sustainable culture that we can, the very best we can. So the more we look, the more troubling we find about Hillary's close relationship with promoting Monsanto's agenda around the world, agenda that has killed farmers, things that have happened, suicides that have happened around the world, promoting that. So, you know, it's not enough to just overlook something as important as that, because these things do matter. And I'm so glad when I look around and I see countries saying no to the GMOs. And I was really happy to see that a few months ago, Russia banned all U.S. corn and soy imports due to GMO contamination. They checked them. Russia's food safety regulator, Rosaljoznadzor, announced a complete ban that started in February on all U.S. corn and soy imports. It's a huge blow to the organic and GM farmers alike, though the ban will be instated due to genetically modified crop and microbial contamination. So by contaminating other crops, we're losing out for everyone. We end up losing out for the good organic farmers as well, because he's banning all U.S. and soy imports for corn and soy, because in Russia they don't want the contamination. They say no. Many countries are saying no to GMOs around the world, and by pushing something people don't want, we're losing business. The total exports to Russia from the U.S. are small in comparison to soybean exports, totaling over $156 million in recent years, with Russia importing 4,742 metric tons of U.S. corn. So not nearly. It's mostly the soy. But they said restrictions will be imposed on imports started a few months ago, and that they are going to have to establish a system to ensure safety of products imported to Russia. China has issued similar bans in the past due to GM contamination. So that contamination is real, and they are trying to work that out. But U.S. corn exports to the country recently dropped by 85% after a report detailing the genetically modified contamination was released. Vladimir Putin said that Russians need to be protected from GM crops. The latest food ban follows that credo. According to the regulator, the corn imported from the United States is often infected with dry rot of maize. And according to the Russian watchdog, corn can be used for transgenic crops in Russia. The potential damage from import and spread of quarantinable objects on the territory is estimated at a very high number, 126 million rubles annually. So their combination of microbial disease and genetically mutated genes are a concern for Russia, China, and multiple other countries who are refusing GM imports from the United States. So we need to not, why should we even be promoting them? We don't even want them here. We need to just do something better, do something much better. We have better options out there. And, you know, it's important that we do that. So it's funny how some things get in the news and then some things have been sitting there the whole time and no one notices. And some of these issues we're just starting to address in our society because we've just been blindly believing, oh, of course it's good. Oh, of course it's good. We wouldn't be using it if it wasn't better. But in fact, it's terrible. Chemical ag is really hurting the planet and hurting us and contaminating water and soil all over the place and then contaminating the good stuff. And it's funny how, you know, you have water quality issues that happen in Flint, Michigan recently, but then there are areas in our country, the Navajo water supply is even more toxic than what has been going on in Flint, but no one notices. And so sometimes we just have to spread our awareness around a little bit and realize that all of this chemistry that we're putting out there and all of these contaminants in our environment are definitely affecting our water supply, our crops, and everything that we are in relationship to out there in life. And in the garden with Patrick Battle, who is now with us for our visit. And, you know, we didn't get to hear from you last week, Pat, but of course it's full time ahead now and we're past that illusory frost date, right? But anything can happen.
That's a laughable one.
Right.
Yeah, that's totally laughable. It was 26 on Saturday night at our house in CeeLo.
Wow.
Yeah. And it froze hard here. We had plants that took a little hit, you know, stuff that we hadn't hardened off quite perfectly, you know. So, yeah, we're past somebody's fantasy frost-free day.
Well, I was like, where did that come from when I saw that? Who thought of that, you know?
Right. That and 475 will get you a latte at Starbucks, you know. Anyway, it's still totally up in the air what's going to happen as far as frost goes. But you just got to plant, you know. I mean, right now you look at the weather prediction for the next week and it looks settled, you know. But we never know. A big front comes through and boom, it all changes. I've said it plenty of times, you know, late May, you know, well into the third week of May, all over Western North Carolina back in 2003, hard freeze everywhere, you know. We have to remember it's always an average frost-free date. They pushed it way back. Maybe we will see some years where we don't see any frost after that date, but it is average, and gardening is not an average endeavor. So,
right, and now we have all of the things blooming everywhere. We're just in the middle of that greening up of the mountain. So, what a joy that is!
It is, yeah, totally. Though I'm seeing less insect activity, and I think it's because it's dry,
very dry, right?
Yeah. So there's just not as many. I'm doing a talk. I'm going to be the farmer. Resource person as part of a talk that Nancy Adamson and Mark Schoenbeck are giving at a SAIR cover crop conference in July, which unfortunately is already sold out, so I can't encourage people to go to it. But for that, I'm trying to like really focus on getting pictures of beneficials and cover crops. I'm seeing way less activity than usual. It's just too dry. The bugs just are not able to multiply as fast. They need those water sources. You know, we always promote growing the cup plant because it's a water source even when there isn't, like, you know, water. You know, when it rains, little pools of water are here and there, little spots of water, and insects really rely on those, you know. And a lot of the insects we really rely on are very short-distance flyers. The baconid wasp, I mean, to ask them to fly from the top of the garden to the stream and back is asking a lot, you know. And so we don't have as much activity as we would sometimes.
Well, it is exciting to see nature coming back alive and seeing the bats. And I have been watering out there because I've got seedlings growing in the ground and in trays. And so I just tell you the same. It's the cutest little everybody. You can tell it's the same insects for a while now. That several different butterflies. I saw a butterfly I've never seen before the other day. Got a shot of it. I was amazed. I'm looking forward to seeing if I can find out what that is. And of course, the little bumblebees all over the place. And just saw the first hummingbird just a couple of days ago. So it's been nice and seeing all that activity and lots of little insects going on. So I've been getting quite a bit, I think, from the watering is definitely helping.
The watering would definitely help. Yeah. And we just got our spring water hooked up. You know, we've switched off of using the stream water because of the Phytophthora capsici. Just got our spring water. It's getting hooked up today. And before we even try and go to the drip, we're probably going to turn the overheads on just to get some water out there and create that, you know. And what's interesting is the garden here at Mr. Ed is, as you know, in a bowl and has lots of water always. And so the cover crops are still like booming and looking really healthy here. But when we get further out to the 4-acre field in Grandview or the new North River farm, the cover crops are less than a foot tall when they should be 3 or 4 feet tall right now.
Wow.
And it's just, there's no water, you know. Literally, we're doing the mugwort trial. I think I've talked about that on the show before. And key to showing that we can control mugwort with rolling and no-till drilling is that we get enough biomass to smother the mugwort. And I think we're going to actually have to set a pump down at the river and water 3 acres of a trial in order to actually get results that we can use. And that's a surprise, but it shouldn't surprise me. We've had years like this before, you know. And I'm operating. I'm in the mode now. I'm operating. We're going to be in a drought. But I'm certainly not predicting that. And I'm certainly not in any way desiring it, you know. Much as I'd love to have as many tomatoes as I can get, a drought is just way too hard on our ecology. But I'm afraid we might be headed into one. I hope I'm wrong. But back in the late 80s, we had a pretty significant El Nino. And the result of that El Nino was a very dry year. So dry that farmers from the Midwest were bringing hay out here to the cattle farmers out here because their pastures didn't grow at all. They were losing their farms because they couldn't feed their cattle.
Wow. Well, you know, of course, down in Texas, 20 inches of rain just in a few hours the other day, and now more rain on the way. I have lots of friends and family down there who live in Houston and that area and are flooding in the neighborhoods. And then, of course, I don't know if you know yet, Pat, but I can't even believe this, and this is my, like, wah-wah thing for today. What are we going to do? They already found late blight in South Carolina.
I know. I do know that. Yes, I do know that. It's, like, totally blowing my mind.
Never, like, right?
Yeah. No, it's, like, yeah. I mean, it may be that it's so warm that it came up from Florida, or it may also be that somebody in the Gulf region is raising tomatoes and, you know, left some potatoes in the ground. They wouldn't die there. They could come up early with late blight, could come into their greenhouse, and they may be just spreading it, you know. I think it was probably 2000, I'm guessing 5 or 6, maybe it was even 7, Walmart and Lowe's, just maybe it was even later. It might have been in the early teens of the 2000s. But one of those years, Walmart and Lowe's just, like, shipped late blight infected plants all over the Northeast. And basically gave the entire Northeast late blight. Places that never get it got it because all the plants had it when they planted them out, you know. And so that may also be what's happening. You know?
So I'm trying to think of some really ingenious way to somehow beat the late blight before it comes, because I just started all these tomatoes. And
ingenious way that you can easily do is to make yourself a little hoop house and grow them undercover.
Right.
Keep them dry. Keep them dry, and they will be very easy to keep. You still have to spray them some, but it's so much easier to keep them from getting late blight if you keep them dry, you know. And indeed, if you can totally close that greenhouse up and just stay out of it on those days when it's, like, very cool and there's mist everywhere, and those nights when it's like that, you may never even have to spray, you know. If those leaves don't get wet and those swimming spores, literally the late blight spores can swim through the air, if they don't get to your plants, then you don't get late blight, you know?
Right, right.
And if they land and the leaf is dry, they don't germinate, you know? And then next time you put compost tea out, they're just food for the organisms in that compost tea, you know? I know that Taylor's doing lots of compost tea. Definitely do that. Lay that compost tea to it. You know, I'll chat with them about, like, trying different feeding schedules. You know, two times here back about 3 years ago, we utterly destroyed late blight. One time, complete 100% destruction of it, and another time, like, 97%, you know. Now, the truth is 97% won't do you any good because that little bit can grow. But the fact that we got that close means it can be done, you know. We just haven't focused on absolutely reproducing everything we did that time, you know, but it had a lot to do with Marshall feeling like he'd been out there spraying for hours and hours, and his tea was starting to smell a little different. He thought, I need to feed it. And he gave it a little slug of hydrolyzed fish and seaweed. And then he sprayed the tomatoes, which really we weren't even trying to grow a crop. It was a test crop for John Nilsson and for a biochar crop. But they had late blight on them. You know, when I came and I walked through the next day and I looked at it, I know what dead late blight looks like. I've been around it too long. And I just said to Jeremy, was that late blight? And he was like, yeah, it was late blight. And it was all dead. And I asked Marshall, did you spray anything other than tea? And he sprayed nothing but tea. So it's simply a matter of making the right tea and feeding it at the right time, and we can control that late blight with tea.
Right. So like as far as the daytime, because you don't want the moisture on the leaves, right? You just want it to dry out enough.
Well, he actually put it on in the evening.
Uh-huh.
But the thing is, what they put out there was something that was antagonistic to the late blight, you know?
Right.
Yeah. And so it didn't matter, because why you don't want to put it out there, why you don't want to get the leaves wet in the evening is they won't dry, and it's a better chance for the late blight to germinate and begin to grow. But if when you put down your moisture, you're putting down something that eats late blight, it doesn't really matter if the leaf is moist. You want that leaf to be moist so that life that you're putting down can attach itself to the leaf and get established, you know? So we regularly spray tea in the evening because we want to have a time when the stomata are open for a good long time, so there's plenty of time for those nutrients and that life to move inside the plant and become part of the plant system. And we get really good results. I mean, I don't think we've ever caused disease by spraying tea. You know, I think it's always worked fine, even though we are putting moisture on at a time that you normally wouldn't do.
Right, because I was always kind of concerned about that. I thought, well, not sure, you know.
Well, it's a good thing to be, because you want to avoid getting your plants wet when they can't dry out. You know, wet plants is an invitation for disease. We always want the soil nice and moist, but, you know, we don't need our plants to be wet. Now, I wouldn't begin to say that there probably aren't functions of rain that have to do with how plants thrive, because the whole world works that everything interacts and benefits from everything else. So there probably are ways that rain benefits plants. But even if you believe that and want to do experiments and test that, you probably want to do it early in the morning when it's going to be nice and sunny and warm, so that those leaves dry out, because having wet leaves is an invitation for disease. There's no doubt about it.
Well, hopefully we will get a good, nice shift right into spring and into later spring and summer coming up, and not have any massive mega freezes going on. Have you heard about fruit set for the apple people? I think they did okay, didn't they?
So far, I think it's pretty okay most places. Even in CeeLo at the 26, the trees weren't open so much that they were looking damaged, you know? And it looks like even some of the peach blossoms might survive, though we don't have to do much thinning. They've been hit enough times.
Right, and then, of course, this weekend we have the big plant sale, the big
Growing
in the Mountains plant sale there at the WNC Farmers Market. And I know you know a lot of folks there. And some of the fun plants you would recommend, Pat? Because I love supporting a lot of people out there like Beth Trigg and many folks selling their beautiful plants that they have.
Well, ones that I sometimes need to get, but this year we tend to have starts of all of them. But many a year I fail to keep a lemon verbena going. I fail to keep a pineapple sage going. I do have to get a stevia, you know. I mean, you can start stevia from seed, but it's like trying to start rosemary or something. You will plant like a flat and you'll get like three plants, you know. So I'd rather go out and buy one or two nice, big, robust, healthy stevias and take cuttings. They root about as easily as mint, you know. And
wow.
If anybody hasn't seen our video, it's as simple as getting growth that is not so soft that like kind of falls over when you hold it, but growth that's firmed up, and cutting back to that point, stripping the lower leaves off, sticking it in a light soil, and firming that cutting that you've done very well, and then watering it well and maybe setting it. What you could do if you're real small time is put that flat in a plastic bag, set it on top of the fridge. And then it'll be kind of warm up there on top of the fridge. The plastic bag will create the humidity. In a matter of days, it'll be cranking. It'll be doing very well. And so that's one way to do it, you know. I obviously don't put them on the fridge, the table in the greenhouse, and wait for them to not wilt in the sun. And then I come and bring them up top. And within a matter of a week or two, they're rooted, and I can plant them out. So pretty darn easy and very satisfying. And so I'll be doing that with that. I have over the years always sought out things like bay if I didn't have bay. But now I have two really lovely trees. And I thought, I'd been told by people at the market that they were hard to start. So I was thinking I was going to have to air layer them. Have we ever talked about air layering?
That's where you I don't think so.
You take a soda bottle. I have some pictures. I'll have to share them with you. Jeremy did it to a fig, which is not really needed because figs are so easy to root. But he just wanted to see how it worked. So you take a soda bottle, and probably a green one or something, so it doesn't get too hot, you know. And you put that, cut it in half, and fill it with peat moss or something similar. Maybe leaf mold would probably work too. And then you wire that around your branch of a fig. And he did two. In one, he scratched the bark on the fig. He also went over some leaf nodes. And the one that he scratched the bark on, we just gave it a long time. You know, he moistened that peat really well and then sealed the bottle up so that the moisture wouldn't go away. And it was probably several months later, but when we opened it up, the entire bottle was filled with roots. And you had yourself a cutting ready to go. So I thought I probably had to do that with the bay in order to get it to root, because I'd always heard from various people at the market that it was hard to get to root. But according to Meredith, it's not that hard to root at all. So I might not have to do that. I might be able to just go ahead and root them the standard way. But that's one that if I didn't have this year, I'd probably be buying, because I want to share the joy of having bay leaves, fresh bay leaves all the time.
Oh, they're so fragrant. They're like a whole other dimension when they're fresh. They're just so much better.
Well, and my plan is that that's one that'll keep its leaves through the winter. And of course, over time, we're going to want to have little forests growing for the soldier flies for their little love areas so that the soldier flies can reproduce, you know. So that's one that I would probably get. I mean, maybe folks can find moringa at the market right now. That'd be one to be looking for if you've never grown moringa. Get to know that one. If you don't have lavender and rosemary and all those, that's a great place to get started with those Mediterranean herbs. You don't need a whole lot. One plant can become the mother for many, many plants, you know. Beginning of this last week, we had a request from, I think it was the Black Mountain Community Garden for, the, you know, we grow seedlings for the Gardens for the Hungry, and they wanted 24 oregano. And Meredith was like looking at all through our seeds and we don't have any oregano seed. And I said, we don't want to use oregano seed anyways, because oregano is like mint. You know, if you get seed, you know, from sexual reproduction, which is what seed is a result of, it's as variable as humans are. And what we're trying to get is a set flavor and a set amount of volatile oils in the oregano. So we grow Greek oregano, and I said, Meredith, don't worry, I'll just go to get a clump. And I grabbed a little clump and just pulled all those little plants together and set them all in. And by the time the rest of the plants that Lord's Acre ordered are ready, they'll have 24 plants. And so that's how you want to propagate those kinds of herbs. So if you buy one oregano, put it in a bigger pot or stick it out in the ground, within a matter of, you know, a month and a half, you'll be able to divide that and share it with all your friends easily. And that's basically the kind of thing that I do when I go to market. I tend not to go, oh, gee, I want to have, you know, four sage plants, so I buy four sage plants. I'll buy one, take cuttings, and start myself five or six, have a few to spare or a guarantee in case they don't all root, you know. And that, those are the kinds of things that I tend to get at the market. You know, I might swing by. Diane and I went to a meeting with a bunch of other people in CeeLo that's beginning to explore doing a little Chinese medicinal herb cooperative. And we met up at Mountain Gardens with Joe Hollis. And I might swing by and see what he's got and get some medicinal plants, some Chinese medicinals, and start those just to grow seed. I mean, that's our plan for starting. You know, turns out that the one that I think I've talked about how thrilled I was to get the licorice root to germinate, because it's a tough one to germinate, and it's incredible Chinese medicinal, really powerful immune system modulator and antiviral, just a powerful herb, you know. One you want to use carefully, because if you are at risk for high blood pressure, it can also cause high blood pressure, but episodic use for a cold or something is not going to hurt you. You know, you just want to be careful about regular use. Anyway, I wanted to grow that, and I was quite daunted by the instructions, because I was supposed to put it in moist sand. I think I left it in the fridge in moist sand for about 14 weeks. And then you take it out and you find those seeds in the sand, which I thought would be hard, but of course they'd swollen in the sand. They were these tiny little things when I put them in, but they were the size of a fenugreek seed by the time I took them out. I don't know how many people know what a fenugreek seed looks like, but if you stop by the French Broad Food Co-op, you can look on there in their herb room and you'll see that fenugreek seed. Fenugreek is one that I should talk about. It's a pretty special plant. But basically then once you take them out of that sand, you sandpaper the seeds which you've been stratifying in the fridge in wet sand for a long time. And I put those out, and I got about 50% germination, and have been sharing those plants, quite confident that I could start more. Lo and behold, I talked to Joe. He said it took him 30 years to get his first licorice to germinate.
Oh my goodness!
So
gracious.
He had tried there. You know, there's probably as many ways to get these tough things to germinate as there are growers. You know, so he tried many other systems. He finally got it to germinate by pouring boiling water over it. And so I might swing by and say, okay, what do you need? What do you need us to grow seed for? What kind of plants? You know, and if people haven't done that, they should definitely find Joe Hollis. His booth and Robert Itis's are one of the kinds. They usually share a space, and they're going to have the most esoteric mountain herbs, and Joe will have all kinds of Chinese medicinals, and he'll have perennial vegetables and just stuff you're not going to see at a lot of the other booths. Not to say you shouldn't check out every booth. They're all interesting. I mean to slight none of my friends and fellow growers at the market, you know, but just make sure you don't miss Joe's, because it's going to be very different. And you know, the truth is he tends to have real little plants a lot. Because a lot of the ones he's selling are very slow growers and slow germinators, witness licorice that I just talked about. So he may not be the most impressive looking, but for getting that diversity, that absolute complete diversity of everything you can find at the market, Joe's, and like I said, he shares with Robert Itis, who kind of specializes in the woodland perennials. Robert's been real active in the plant rescue movement, you know, the people that go out where they're going to put a new road in or something and dig up all the stuff that's going to be destroyed and then moves them around and shares them and stuff. And so he's got a lot of those kinds of just wonderful woodland ephemerals and stuff like that.
Well, it really sounds great. I'm glad you reminded me about Joe, because he's definitely a living mountain treasure here. And I love stopping at his place on the farm tour. That was the one place I finally volunteered there for ASAP, because I was like, that's the only place I just go there and I never leave anyway. So
Yeah. You know, it's funny. He's right up the road from me. I used to live there. I wouldn't really say an internship. I wasn't really being trained by Joe, but I got there in the spring and he said, you grow the vegetables, I'll grow the flowers, you know? He was just on it, you know, but we made rock walls together, and I spent a long, you know, summer. It was basically a growing season from early April, I think I got there, and I stayed there till the end of October, you know? And so I really know that garden really well. Some of the larger rocks, Joe and I moved together in place for some of those walls. I know it really well. It's changed so much since I was there in the late 70s. And regularly for years, Di and I would make it a point to visit there every year. But I have not been up there probably in 5 or 6 years. And
wow.
It was just a pleasure. It was right towards dusk. I didn't get to spend much time there. But I'm glad Diane said, let's go to that meeting. Let's think about growing Chinese herbs. And it got me to reconnect with mountain gardens. Well, I'm sure we'll have more meetings, and I'll get to get there a little early and just walk around and enjoy and see. I mean, all those like ornamental conifers and stuff, they weren't even in the ground when I first was there. You know, they weren't even planted. And then over the years, I watched them put those in, and it's just changed so incredibly over the years and so wonderfully. You know, I mean, it's definitely, Joe has created a gift to the world with his garden. Absolutely.
Yeah, it is truly astonishing to see that little 4.5-acre property that goes up to the forest, and how he talked about how he just has transformed it. You can just see it's like a little Garden of Eden. You feel like you're in this huge lost paradise, and then you turn around and it's right there. It's this little tiny area, but it's big enough that you can just lose yourself in a lot of the little trails and all of the great stories that go along with all those plants. It's great to hear you were part of that. I truly have loved that place for so many years. And when I first found it, I just fell in love over there, and I thought it was great. And great things happened there. You know, that outdoor kitchen, that day I volunteered with ASAP and sat there to help out with people walking up to tour. You know, they just pulled in some chanterelle mushrooms, and then I had some other local farm cheese, and we just all sat there, and someone had found a big giant chunk of kyanite and, you know, cluster, and it was just like this afternoon of eating some forage food and some shared food. And of course, the library being the best, and then the seed library as well. I just met a woman at Mother Earth News Fair who is a Chinese herbologist and works with Chinese medicine, and she didn't know about Joe. She was not from the area, and she's heading over there now and can't wait to meet and greet him there and see the seeds and things he has, because she's interested in growing the seeds as well and growing the plants for her use in her practice. And so it's just so great to discover him and then now to be able to share that and just... I'd like to get up there again, too, because it's been a while. You know, it's always changing, but yet it's that familiar, amazing garden that he's created.
Well, and Joe's gone through so many iterations of what he's interested in. When I got there, it was alpines. He was interested in alpine plants, and then he was, of course, always interested in the native flora of here and the medicinals of here. And then it became Chinese medicine. And then years ago, I had sciatica, and I was attending, going to an acupuncturist, and she has a acupuncture school, and she wanted me to grow plants for them and help them to learn how to grow Chinese herbs. And it was like, okay, I know when I have to pass on a reference here. It's like, you don't want me, you want Joe. I mean, yeah, I can learn him, but Joe knows him. I mean, Joe's grip on Chinese pharmacology is probably as extensive as the better acupuncturist. I mean, he just knows all those plants and their uses. It's just incredible, the incredible expertise that he has.
It is. It's
Huge
really great.
research
And then he
on
has his library there
acupuncture
that you can
and
just dig
pharmacy.
in there.
And he actually teaches at that acupuncture clinic.
Oh, wow. Are you there?
Are you there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here. We just got all silent for a moment there.
Ooh, I
I
would
was
too.
saying I love his library as well because he's got all of these great resources. You can just sit there for hours and look up things and look up conditions and look up various Chinese herbs and it's all just sitting right there and it's really nothing like a great library. Can you hear me? What happened? Hello.
Hello.
There you are. Okay.
Hello.
Hi there. Can you hear us?
Hello.
Oh, what happened? Oh,
Hello.
we were just on there with Patrick Battle talking to us about things. Let's see. Patrick, can you hear us? Let's see if we can get him again. Hello, Patrick, can you hear us? Oh, darn. Hello, Pat. Can you hear us? I can hear Pat. I can hear him breathing. But I can't. Apparently, he can't hear us. Darn. There he comes again. Let's see if we can get it this time. Okay, Pat, can you hear us? Hello, can you hear us? Oh, man. I wonder how this happens. We were just there and we were having such a great conversation.
Hello?
Hey, are you there? Can you hear
Are you
us?
there?
Yes. I can hear
Hey,
you.
Lisa.
I can
Okay,
hear
it looks like I
you.
lost you today. It looks like we're done for today.
I can hear you though. Oh.
I don't think I'm getting you back. I don't know what happened.
All right, awesome. Well, big hugs and thanks for everything. And we'll talk to Pat again next week, right here on Earth Heart Network Radio. Lots of great stories to share and much information. We'll try him one more time. Pat, can you hear us?
I cannot hear you. I don't know if you can hear me. Too bad I wanted to talk about what you should be doing right now, but
Yeah,
okay.
I can hear you. That's great. I can, but darn, he doesn't know it. All right, well, inexplicable technical
All right, well, you can
difficulties.
hear me. So you know what? I'm just going
Oh,
to
good. Okay.
assume that you want me to, and I'm going to say what we are doing this week and what should be on schedule. You can email me if you don't want that. Okay, good. All right. So I can't hear you. Don't know why, but right now, of course, you have to be irrigating as much as needed. Remember that your seedlings will dry out real quickly this time of year. Anything you have in the ground, you have to irrigate. We can't count on the rain for right now. And as you get things really well watered, think about mulching them so you don't have to keep watering. That's one solution. But you may just want to, instead, if you don't have time for mulching, you may just want to set up some kind of drip system that's not hard to turn on and off and rely on that. If you have not started your warm weather crops, now's a fine time to do it. You might have started them already, but now is not anywhere near too late for tomatoes, peppers, eggplant, squash. A little early for okra and melons. I might wait a little bit on those. Cucumbers, you can start now. All of your favorite summer flowers, now's the time to start them. You should be planting out as fast as you can all of those spring plants that you've started, Especially spinach and beets, things like that. If you have those started, get those in the ground today, Get your broccoli, your cauliflower in the ground now. Remember, if we have frost coming, to protect that broccoli and cauliflower with row cover. A little bit too much cold can cause it to button up early. But things like kale and collards will probably just thrive unless you haven't hardened them off. If you have not hardened them off, I put them in the ground because it's predicted to be warm for the next week or so. But watch the weather. If they change that prediction, get out there with the row cover. Maybe set the row cover up the way we've described over and over again. We'll describe it one more time. Take it out there, lay it out, put it over the bed, and then staple the windward side, right? And that's usually the north or the west side. Staple the leeward side. So that when the wind blows, right, it blows the cover over. I'm wrong. Pardon me. Sometimes I lose track. You do want to staple the windward side. Staple the windward side so then when the wind blows, it picks that cover up and blows it over to the leeward side. And really, some nights you could probably even just leave the staples off, but I never do. I always put a few staples on the leeward side, but there's no effort to it. You're not struggling with the wind. You can cover it up even if we get a last-minute warning that it's going to be really cold, you know. Go to the farmer's market where the herb festival we talked about earlier is happening, and get those plants that you have not started that are hard to start, those Mediterranean herbs, maybe stevia, get all those kinds of plants. Think about propagation. Maybe get, you know, buy one, make a bunch, you know. Great time of year to do that. If you have any questions about how to do that propagation, we have a video up about that. It's very easy. I'm not going to try and give all the descriptions of it right now. That's a great thing you can do. If you have fruit trees, you might want to get online and look at our Michael Phillips video and look at the various sprays that you want to do this time of year to try to ensure that those fruit trees do not disappoint you because of such, you know, painful diseases as brown rot, which can totally wipe out a crop of stone fruits. And so learn about those. Learn to be on the lookout for fire blight. You know, that's not a fungus. It's a bacterial disease, but it can be devastating if you have the right sprays. You can nip it in the bud, you know. Speaking of nipping in the bud, I'm actually going to be grafting in the immediate future. We got loads of wonderful Scion wood from Ed Updike, and I'm going to be grafting. It's a fine time of year to graft. You can do either the wedge graft or, gee, I don't even know how to describe the other one. The wedge graft is one where you actually literally, it's the one you videoed, Lisa, where you take something like what looks like a meat cleaver and you drive that into a sawn off limb and you drive it in enough that you split open a crevice in the middle of that that limb, and then you take your Scion wood and you slice it in a kind of a pencil slicing. Not quite though, because you don't strip off the two side edges. You just are cutting it's as if you made a pencil, but you were using a knife and you didn't have a pencil sharpener. And so you only just kind of sliced the top and the bottom of that. And you got a tip that way. And then you take that and you slide that in right at the edge of that opening that you've made there, so that the cambium on that Scion wood and the cambium in the tree are matched up. And, you know, that's not going to be that easy to do without looking at a video. And I don't know if we have ours up yet, but I know that there are videos online about that. But it's something to think about doing. If you have access to some great wood that you really like that somebody has kept refrigerated, you can't really right now go get Scion wood that's already in full growth and try to transplant it on. But if somebody who you know has refrigerated some wood because they were going to graft, they saved too much, which is not at all uncommon, you could still graft some of your favorite fruit onto some of the trees you have if they're not performing so well. You know, we've done several grafts and I intend to do many more. My main goal is to get all of Ed's Scion wood on some tree so we still have that wood, even if Ed sells his property to somebody who's not going to be into sharing those amazing old-timey Lee Calhoun, who is the, you know, the major preserver of the old-timey apples in the Southeast, and is an author of a book about that. These are all the trees he recommends. And so I'm going to be doing that kind of grafting. You can graft later on if you watch our video. I think we have that one online. You can correct me, Lisa, when I get off if I'm wrong about that, where Bob shows bud grafting in June. We're going to be doing that too later on. But right now you could be grafting, and that's something you should definitely be looking at. It's a good time of year. We just got a huge load of the wood chips from the power company. They came through and we're clearing, you know, protecting their lines. And we got them to drop off one huge load. We hope to get another. We're going to put wood chips around all of our perennials. And indeed, we'll be inoculating them with wine cap Strepharia rugosa annulata, a very easy mushroom to grow. You simply have to mix it into fresh wood chips and then stand back and let them grow. And just know that once you see those mushrooms, you want to learn how to ID them. They're very distinctive. when they open up where their veil separates from the stem, the way it separates, it almost looks like teeth. There's such, the veil is so big. So it looks like somebody had a mouthful of teeth and maybe they got whacked because it's not regular. So it looks like some of the teeth got knocked out. But it's pretty easy to identify that. You want to make sure you identify it well and know if you get those to grow that you want to pick them incredibly young. If they get much more than slightly open, they tend to get really infested with the larva, the worms to get in mushrooms. So it's one that think about growing if you're going to be putting wood chips out. One to use quickly. And you know what? If you don't get them, if the worms get them, it doesn't matter because they're breaking down those chips and those chips are feeding all of your perennial plantings. We just planted some hardy kiwi that Ed Updike gave us today, the interns and myself, and it was a pleasure to get those in. Do think to strategically plant when you're planting fruit trees. Try to always plant if you have it on a slope and try to plant higher up on the slopes so the cold settles away from your fruit trees. That was totally the place, how I picked the place for the hardy kiwi. You know, if you're planting in the, you know, we have our garden at Mr. Ed here, Mills River Educational Farm, is quite a bowl. And so if I tried to plant fruit trees right in the garden, they would almost always get frosted. Instead, I'm getting up on the edges where it's kind of high, some of the more marginal looking land, improving the soil as much as I can and planting there so that the cold drops away from it. So those are the kind of main things I'd say to look at doing this time of year. You may need to protect your seedlings from flea beetles. We are getting some control from our compost tea last year. You may want to think actually about trying spraying out some beneficial nematodes this spring when the soil gets above 60 but is below 80. You can either water in or spray in as long as you water afterwards for at least 5-10 minutes with a gentle stream so you get those nematodes to swim down into the soil. If you can establish them, they will control any number of soil garden pests. Cutworms, flea beetles, Japanese beetles. They won't solve your Japanese beetle problem because, of course, you're not putting the nematodes on all of your neighbor's lawns and on the hay fields and whatnot around you, and the Japanese beetle larvae are out there too. But it will help to reduce the Japanese beetle numbers and will greatly reduce, if not eliminate, your flea beetle pressure. Take care of things like cutworms. Really a great thing to do. I highly recommend looking into applying beneficial nematodes. Okay, I think that's about it. I hate that I can't hear you back. I think this is the impetus to try to quit working with this headphone, decide that it is no longer good, and go get another one. So hopefully next week I'll have a new headphone, and I will be able to hear you too.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to sign off. Happy gardening to everybody. And Lisa, thanks a whole lot. Bye-bye.
All right. That is Patrick Battle this week in the garden. For some reason, we couldn't communicate there at the end, but we got to hear Pat and his great insights and all of those important instructions for things we could be doing. Amazing array of the actions to take out in the garden right now. So happy springtime, April 20th here, and a beautiful day out there. So get growing. Stop mowing and get growing, right? Keep that garden pumping along and stay inspired throughout the season. We'll talk to you again next week right here on Earth Heart Network Radio.